You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today is Leslie John, who is the James E. Burke Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her award-winning research appears in top academic journals and media, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and The Economist. Prior to her academic career, she was an internationally trained ballet dancer. Her new book is called Revealing, The Underrated Power of Oversharing. You're going to enjoy this pod. Leslie John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kelly. I mean, we have so many mutual friends. I can't believe we haven't actually met. Someday we'll meet in the flesh, but this is
of course, I'm reading this book, and how I gauge how into a book I am is how much I'm annoying my wife because I'm reading her passages. So she's just like, just let me read the book. But here's where I want to start. I thought about this a lot. Here's where I want to start the conversation. I'm going to tell you a personal story, true story about my life. And then you can tell me the science behind what happened in the story.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. So it's 2001 and I got invited to go to a very rich person's house for a fundraiser for Rahm Emanuel, who was then running for Congress. It was almost all very wealthy people. I am not. But I was probably invited because I had this cool job running Second City at the time. I only knew a few people, and I find myself in a corner next to a woman who also seems slightly out of place. She asked me how I found myself at this event, and I said something like, well, it's not because I have money, but I did hire Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey at Second City, and Rahm knows to call me when he wants free tickets to Second City. And she comes back with, well, I can tell you that I'm the only Republican at this event. And we go on to have this very rich and funny conversation. It's raining. I have an umbrella. She doesn't. I walk her back to her apartment, which is actually kind of near Second City. And this becomes my friend, Sean, who I literally have had lunch with once a year, every single year since this meeting. We don't do business together. We don't socialize. We have lunch every year and we share everything that's important to us in our lives.
Amazing.
And that's gone on since 2001.
Wow, that's so beautiful. I love that so much.
So now
it's like no pressure,
LJ, right?
Analyze it. I think that this feels a little bit like the strangers on a plane phenomenon where, you know, you have that phenomenon of, I've had it, I've done it, I've been on the receiving end. You're sitting on the plane and you just find yourself completely opening up to the stranger sitting next to you. And I think part of it is, you know, it's this freedom that you know that you're probably never going to see this person again. So what's the risk, right? And I mean, maybe it's also in the plane situation, partly driven by this is to get dark, but this kind of maybe belief that if you crashed, they'll take your secrets to the grave. But, sorry, I went way dark there. So it's like a little bit, you know, there's this person, you're in this place, this fancy place that there's kind of, you don't have any established norms. And then you meet this person and you're both kind of outsiders and you kind of go in very different circles. So you, in the back of your mind, you're like, well, what the heck? I'm never going to see them. But then maybe there's also this feeling or need to bond with the person because you feel like outsiders. So you kind of want to connect in a way, right? Maybe you weren't overtly conscious about it. I'm sure I'm overanalyzing this, but as you know, that's what we do.
Nope,
and it's fun to analyze. But, yeah. And then But then you found yourself surprised that you really hit it off. And then you want to see the person again, which I think is the beauty of it. It's like it starts off as this thing that's like, oh, what the heck? And maybe you shared more than you normally would, right? Because it's so low risk because you're never going to see them again. But then by virtue of having shared, you actually then realized, oh, this is amazing. There's a connection. And I think that's, and then you keep seeing her and once a year. And I think you've really hit on something key there, because when we decide what to reveal, to the extent we're even thinking about the possibility of opening up, which we don't think about often enough, we don't consider opening enough up often enough. But when we do think about whether to say the thing, we often hold back because the number one thing we think about is the risk of revealing. Like, oh no, I'm going to say too much. It's going to be cringy. I'm going to ruminate. And so, it's like thinking that you're never going to see the person again removes that anxiety. It's interesting though, because once it's gone, you see it's actually not so risky at all. And you made something really beautiful.
It's such an improv thing, right? And this is, we were talking before we jumped on about the work that we did at the University of Chicago with Nick Epley and his work on self-disclosure. And improv was a natural device by which we could create bespoke exercises to teach people what it was like just to self-disclose a little bit. And that's how you form connection. And we know this from improvisation, because when you're initiating a scene or you're the receiving end, we call it a gift, when you're given a gift, and you yes and that gift, and what you're slowly building is a rapport to make something out of nothing, which is what we're all doing every day. And I was talking to Anne about this when I was reading the book, because she does a thing when she's teaching improv, especially early stage improvisers like her college program, where she says to them, if they're not improvising well, she's like, try improvising with real things from your life. Inevitably, that makes the improvisation much better, much more interesting, much more true. And so it's we're practicing what it's like to share and build together, and you scale it together too, right? We talk about that, which is that's how this works in a very pro-social way. Now I think it was Nir Eyal who said it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. So con men use this stuff all the time, right?
Right. Totally. Yeah. You know, that's exactly, we're on the same brainwave, because that's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking of that. Gosh, I watch too much. We have small children. So that's like what we do when we're exhausted and I put the kids to bed and watch Netflix. So there's this show. Who's that brilliant actor from the Breaking Bad?
Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
Bryan Cranston.
So there's this show and he basically, his kid does something really bad. Like, I think he might have inadvertently killed someone or something. And the kid needs to have, like, so he's going to lie about it, but he needs an alibi. And the way he says to make the alibi is we have to do the thing. We have to like go to the store where we said we were or something, right? Like you need to go through, and it has to be, it's easier to lie if it's based on something real is the dark side, right? But the beautiful thing about the improv that you're saying is if someone's struggling, you say, start from something from your own life. And do you say to them, like, do you say a funny moment or is it like just something real? It's not, it's like, you don't try to be funny, right? Yeah. Love it.
It's just, it's recognizable, right? So like, cause people, when you are laughing at something is cause you recognize something as being true for you in some way.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be absolutely true. It's just, it's just something from your life. All right. Yeah. So we have many heroes and villains in the Second City Getting the SM podcast. Chief villain is Milton Friedman. I'm just not a fan. But one of the heroes is Mr. Goffman.
Love. Amazing.
Whose work I love. And then, of course, you introduce us to this fellow.
Right.
Let's talk about them because my honest knows a bit about Goffman, but not about the other guy.
That's awesome that you have the other guy's book because it's hard to get it.
It is hard to get. It was expensive. That paperback was expensive. tell us about them.
Okay. So I know it's like you can't make this strange. What is the saying? The truth is stranger than fiction. So there's these two guys. They're both Canadian, which we often don't realize as a Canadian, mm-hmm. although I did just become American, so I'm both. But so Goffman is a famous sociologist figure who, the key thing that he contributed is the understanding of impression management and how we have kind of this front stage and this backstage. And then there's the other character, Sidney Gerard, who is, I think, just his ideas were just as important, but for some reason he's not as famous. And his point was kind of the opposite, which is that we need to be more open. It's okay to let the backstage show front stage, essentially show more of ourselves. And they were both right, but in different ways, right? It's really mm-hmm. important to make an impression and to kind of be reserved and guarded and be careful about what you say and not reveal too much in many situations. But what Goffman got wrong, Gerard got right, and vice versa. And one of the things, and so then I became fascinated with imagining in the book, I get a little bit carried away, but like, what if they had met and what would the conversation have been like and their personalities? And it was interesting because as I learn more about them, there's this saying, all research is me-search. And I think it couldn't have been more true. Like Goffman, he was so guarded in real life, and he was known to not allow people to take photos of him. And the lore is that when he was defending his PhD, you know, this rite of passage / hazing ritual in academia, you stand in front of a tribunal, it seems, of very fancy professors, and they ask you really hard questions. And a single bead of sweat dripped down his face, and apparently he didn't even flinch. And then there's Gerard, who, you know, he couldn't even lie well because he was just so mm-hmm. open. And he would give lectures barefoot down in the University of Florida, where he spent most of his academic life. And, you know, it was really fascinating because I also learned that Gerard, he had this yellow convertible, a Triumph is the name of the car, old school. And he would drive it top down. And I just think that that's such a metaphor for how he was in the world. He died really young. He died at 48. Ironically, he was underneath his Triumph and fixing he was like he's underneath the car, and then it gave way on him. Horrible death. But it's also related to revealing these decisions we make about what to reveal and what not to reveal, his life and how he died. Because when he died, his mother was actually in the hospital. She was elderly and dying, and his family had to decide, do we tell her that her son has died? You know, like what a gut wrenching. I mean, I don't even have the words to say it, that kind of decision, whether to tell the mother. And so they ended up not telling her. She did die a few days later. Was it the right call, the wrong call? I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's just gut wrenching, right? These decisions.
So this is later in the book. Mm-hmm. And it really tested me. The story about Paul.
Oh yeah. Wow. Jeez.
That was, believe me, I went around the office and told people that story, and it was kind of 50-50 in terms of what people were like, or not tell. So tell us that story, and then we can discuss all the different elements.
All the angles. Right. Okay. So Paul is one of 11, one of 12.
11 or 12.
Yeah. It's 11 or 12. So the reason not remembering that is because he's the youngest, and one of his oldest siblings, who he never met, died when he was a baby. Like the brother died when Paul was not alive yet, not born yet. And so Paul, there was always some mystery around Stephen, around his death. And nobody, when he talked to his mom, when he asked his mother whatever happened to Stephen, and she just kind of always gave a bit of an unsatisfying answer and brushed him off. And And so Paul, as the youngest, you know, and he's kind of the family librarian or family, you know, historian, he really, really wanted to know what happened to Stephen, what really happened. And he found out. He was in the middle of COVID, and he was going through old newspapers, and he had this kind of Poirot moment, that famous detective, where he had this aha, and he was looking at found an old newspaper of the couple days after Stephen had died, and it was in the newspaper, and he learned that his brother Stephen died because he was scalded accidentally. His totally tragic, but Paul's older brother, who was, you know, also very young at the time, accidentally pulled the kettle cord, or a series of events led to the kettle falling that was instigated by the Paul's oldest brother, or one of his oldest brothers. And so he found out that the brother was actually responsible, even though it was a completely tragic, unintentional thing. And so what Paul then wrestled with is, do I tell my brother about this? Because the mother, Paul's mother, kept this secret to her grave, you know, and it suddenly put so much more perspective on how wonderful his parents were to Paul, because the brother had a bit of a cantankerous relationship with the father. And Paul said to me, you know, all the times, all the shouting matches, all the times that his father was upset with the brother, like, he never said anything, right? Imagine, like, you know, how hard parenting is, and like, mm-hmm. to never let that slip that mm-hmm. you, right? And so Paul just had so much more admiration, but fundamentally Paul struggled. He's like, do I tell my brother this? And you know, Paul's brother, you know,
my response to this was no yeah. way.
Right. And in fact, and that's what the mother didn't want it, right?
Yeah.
She took the secret to her brave. So grave. So no way. And so your office 50-50. So what were the reasons against and the reasons for?
So the reasons against were all protective in the sense of, why would you give someone this kind of burden, especially when they were innocent?
Yeah.
And then the reasons for, which ultimately I think I moved to, which were, it's almost always better to know. And, you know, mm-hmm. and I just think about this in a variety of contexts from my own life. And, you know, you and I are both oversharers, like significant oversharers. Like, so in public, you know, you do it in the book. I do it in this podcast. I do it in speeches. I talk about really tragic things that have happened to me. And every time I do that, you know, there was a photographer. We lost our daughter, Nora, to cancer when she was 17. And I talk about it a lot. I miss her. I like to invoke her name. And I got great Nora stories. And so I was telling one at a speaking date. And at the end, the photographer came over to me and she just hugged me. And she's like, I lost my kid too. No one ever talks about it. You know what I mean? So there was part of me that was like, and I know that's different, but it was also like, I can think of other contexts in which I want to know. And so when I was thinking about Paul, which is a very different thing, right? I think most people can understand. But in some ways, and I think about other aspects of my life that, like, I want to know. For the most part, I want to know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, I couldn't have said it better. Like, if we don't talk about these things, then it's more anomalous and it's harder to cope, right? So my husband's brother passed away tragically when he was in his early 20s. And, you know, so I never knew his brother. And my husband, you know, he's been to a lot of therapy and he's really, you know, he's gotten through it. It's nothing, it's like, you never get over it, but you get through it, mm-hmm. I think. But my husband's parent, his father is now passed, but they never went to therapy. And I know it's not that you need to go to therapy, but it always feels like it has not been processed. And I think you're exactly right. You like talking about it is really, really important. And I think, you know, part of what Paul faced was the perseveration of feeling like you have a secret, right? And that's really, yeah. really preoccupying. And, you know, he all of a sudden had this secret from his brother. He also had a very unique situation where his brother said he wanted to know, but in a way that, so he said and had said in passing, hey, have you ever
generally.
Find anything out, right? Yeah. yeah. But then it's like yeah. one thing to, and so yeah, as I tell the story in the book, Paul went to enormous lengths to try to figure out, well, if it's like, you can't ask someone, if you were responsible, would you want to know? Right. Cause it's a paradox, but
right.
he really went through this elaborate procedure to really try to simulate that, to figure out if he really truly wanted to know. And then he did get his answer that he really did want to know, or a part of him knew it would be beneficial. And then he told him and it actually,
it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually opened up stuff for the rest of the family.
Exactly. Right. It opened up stuff and it led to so many good things, which is so hard to imagine in prospect, right? Like, how can good become out of something so, so horrible that you would never wish on your worst enemy, even Milton Freeman?
I don't wish any ill will towards Milton Friedman or his descendants. I just don't like his ideas.
100% preach. Yes. Yeah, I just, I was going to say, I lost my train of thought because this is just so important and moving. But, the other thing one thing I was thinking is like another area, not to equate the two at all, but something that is difficult for people, obviously, is pregnancy loss. And, you know, I always feel like it's so, the time when you feel the shittiest and you may need the most support if you happen to lose the pregnancy is like shrouded in secrecy and mystery, right? Like,
yeah.
And I'm pleased. I don't know if that's the right word, but that people are starting to talk more about it. And then you feel less alone if you've experienced it.
There was this moment at Lurie Children's Hospital, Nora was in, and we still didn't know. This is a point where it's like, she could live, you know, this could work.
Did you say she was 17 or it was 17 years ago?
Yeah, she got diagnosed when she was 16 and she passed just like a couple weeks after her 17th birthday. So
gosh,
it was pretty quick. And it was like 8 years ago that she passed or that she got diagnosed actually. So we were in the hospital and in the room next door, I ran into the dad in the little like nook where the refrigerator is and you can get food. And we just started chatting. And it turns out that their teenage son he thought he'd beaten it and it came back. The cancer came back. But this time the son didn't want anyone to know.
Interesting. Interesting.
And this remains for me one of the most upsetting moments, because I realized, well, they were honoring his wish, but in doing so, they were taking on that silence, which was not good.
Right.
It's not good.
No.
And one of my favorite films of all time is Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies.
You know, which
it's brutal. Oh my God.
I gotta see it. Okay, I'm writing it down.
And the title is the thing is she and Leigh, he improvises. So what he does is he does not send out the full script. He sends out character composites to the yeah. actors. They improvise a bit and then they do have scripts, but there's other stuff that is not revealed to them. And so the lie or the secret that gets revealed in the moment is news to that character. And it is like just a profound moment. And it's like, it's, and I'm sure there are areas that I don't want to know. Like I'm sure there are.
Yeah.
But I think they are so in the minority.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not how we're programmed.
Okay. Yeah. 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 I mean, I think like, I'm trying to think of something where I wouldn't I think like if so, I don't know if this is a would be a popular opinion. It's never good to start a sentence like that, but I think if my husband cheated on me and it was like a mistake that was completely meaningless. It was completely meaningless. And it wasn't like a symptom of some problem in our marriage. I think that I wouldn't want to know. But the thing,
interesting. I thought you were going to go the other way.
No, because I was trying to think of like, what is something that true? Cause I'm with you, like openness, you know, we're overshare, but I think when I psychoanalyze it further, I think, but is it really possible for it to truly be a mistake? Like there must be something to, if you're going to do that, like, I don't know if you're on a lot of drugs or something, I don't know. But then it's like, why are you on a lot of drugs? Like that's a problem. But that's one thing that maybe, I don't know.
It's funny. So I just finished Paul Eastwick's book, Bonded by
Evolution. Oh yeah. I really want to read that.
Yeah, no, it's really good. Awesome. And one of the things is sort of like, you know, monogamy, that's a thing and not a thing certain groups. And,
yep.
And we want to think there's this one truth. It's basically breaking the whole evolution idea as applied to relationships, saying that that's not it. There's
like monogamy is not like evolutionarily. Well, because you want to spread the seed.
Yeah, yeah.
We're creatures. Like we need,
But and even more so, we have these romanticized ideas about what a relationship should be.
Yeah.
And I think for most people who have been a part of, if they have, or the opposite, they see it too, is like, no. There's a lot of management going on inside these relationships and staying curious and tending to. It's work. It's actual work.
In monogamy.
And when you make any relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like to keep it going.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me there's another secret that gets revealed, and it's this character that you talk about, Jennifer, in the book. Should we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. I do want to talk about that, but can I just ask you? I wanted to ask you a question about.
Go ahead.
So when you talk about your daughter, when you say it to someone, you know, who doesn't know, like, what is the best way for them to receive it? I never know what to say when someone's like, tells me something. I mean, I guess I could do studies. I have intuitions, but like what is most helpful? It's probably changed over time too.
There's not one. And I can think of a variety of ways, you know, ultimately we all want to be seen. So this is an interesting thing that Anne said. After the first year after Nora died, Anne said, now I understand mourning clothes.
Oh, wow. Yes, because you don't have to say it. It's advertised. Is that right?
Just know. So for people who don't know, and it's mourning. This was a thing. And you would wear a certain kind of mourning clothes, and those clothes would change.
Yeah, black and then lavender, right? Yeah.
So yes, the farther you got away from the event, so people would just know that like a thing happened.
Yeah.
So that would be the easiest. Okay, but we don't have mourning clothes.
Yeah.
So what your eyes did what I want your eyes to do when I just told you.
Huh, say more.
It made you sad. You saw that. You sat with me and let me tell my story. You didn't feel the need to like totally jump in, though jumping in would have been fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had everything from people touch the screen, if I'm on a Zoom call.
I love that.
So they just do that thing. I've had other people like, can I take a moment with you?
Yeah.
You know, and all those things are, you know, useful and good. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can think of that I didn't like was when people sent me like books that were about the afterlife and that.
Oh, wow.
Not science books, like woo-woo books that are sort of like, she's still here.
Her spirit,
I'm like that. I'm throwing this book out. But when someone sent me grief poems, great. That was actually really, poetry was a very big thing for me in terms of my grief stage.
Wow. Yeah.
And then you mentioned therapy before. I would not be sitting here talking to you like I'm talking to you right now had I not had really amazing therapy to integrate this into myself ongoing.
Yeah, completely.
And here's a simple truth, which is I think I'm a better person for having gone through this.
Wow. I mean, that is self-actualization there. That's growth, right? Like it's not the same thing as like you obviously would never wish it on anyone if you could drop a hold back time, if you could control it, if you could make it not happen in a heartbeat, you would, but the growth, right? That's
post-traumatic growth. And you kind of got one or two choices on this stuff, right?
Right.
So many marriages don't survive this sort of thing. I remember a friend of mine telling me that after their sibling died, their parents took down every photograph and never mentioned him again.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my God. And here's something that I actually haven't talked about on here, which is like, we haven't cleaned out her room. Her room is still all the stuff that's left in it.
Wow. Do you ever go in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I realized it's really cold here, and I was like, I bet Nora stole some of my wool socks because I found them.
Oh,
I found a bunch of my wool socks that she stole, and it was funny. It was funny to me.
Oh, now, that's lovely.
Now we need to. It's not a shrine. It's not. It's just we just haven't done it.
Yeah.
And we will. We don't need the extra room.
Do you need to though? Like, is it important? If it feels important to you, then you need to.
I am, it's funny. I've got to talk to Anne about it. Like, I think I'm maybe more, I would do it. I would be the person to do it. Mm-hmm. Like these are the things I do in our marriage, mm-hmm. things like this.
Yeah.
So I just have to check in with my wife and be like, are you cool if I do this? Or what do you want to keep? But this is another thing too, because it's like, we're both in our, well, I'm turning 60. So we're kind of in our 60s and we're, you know, empty nesters. Our son's down in Atlanta. And, you know, we got this house with all this stuff. And I'm like, you're not taking it with us.
Yeah.
And the only person who would have wanted all of it is Nora. Nick doesn't want any of it. So,
yeah.
Yes, my kids are Nick and Nora.
I love that.
So, yeah.
I mean, and how do you even decide what to keep and what to,
that's also part of the thing of why I'm not doing it. Cause you know, I don't know, man. I mean, it was like, yeah, it's, but then, you know, there's a park named after her, that's outside her old school.
Beautiful.
That we can drive by. And it literally was on the way to therapy. It was between my house and the therapist's office.
Wow.
So those rituals all helped.
Yeah. Yeah. Rituals, right. They're comforting.
So, yeah. Tell us about Jennifer.
So Jennifer, and one little tidbit. So my brother and I have two brothers. One of them is hugely into therapy like I am. And the other one is not. He probably, I love them. Obviously what do you, they're just different people. But the one that loves the therapy, when we send each other random texts, like every few weeks we'll get a text, therapy rules. We have like, whenever we have a really good session, we just text each other therapy rules.
Great.
But okay, so Jennifer, yes, I feel like now I'm even dodging that. I know, but it's so good talking to you about this stuff. So Jennifer, there's a story in the book about Jennifer and Jennifer. Well, I mean, Jennifer's me. Spoiler alert. Like I can't, but,
yeah, that's you.
So the thing is like, I was writing the book and writing the book was just so, I don't know if you've experienced this in your writing, but like you realize, okay, behavioral science is informative in many ways, but like to bring it to life, you need a story. And I was really lucky that I worked with some really amazing developmental editors, one of whom was a memoir writer. I didn't intentionally think I need a memoir writer, but we just clicked. And then it was so perfect because she would keep saying like, cut the study, add a story. And now I see that her imprints are all over the book because she's a memoir writer. And anyway, so as I was, I was thinking about a story. I need a story about something that someone undershared and then it affected them consequentially, but then they like found out that it was undershared. It was like this very like specific thing.
Yeah.
And then I woke up literally in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh my God, this is me. I have this story. It's in me. And this is crazy because I've been spending 4 years writing this book on undersharing and me like kind of self-professed oversharer, fancying myself as an oversharer with, you know, lots of self-deprecating, embarrassing stories in the book. You're welcome. But then when I thought that, I'm like, even me, I'm writing a freaking book. And even me, I am undersharing because I realized I kind of like the performative aspect of oversharing in a way because it's fun. But when it came to the really deep, important stuff, I was holding back, specifically that I had this secret that I had been keeping for 10 years, 10 years that I knew this thing about my mom that really affected me. And she didn't know that I knew. And it forced me as I was writing the book, I thought, well, like I'm a hypocrite. Like if I really believe what I'm saying in this book, I have to tell her, I have to have a conversation with her. So I sat down and I told her and how it affected me. And, it was one of the most meaningful conversations I've ever had with anyone. And again, it was one of those things that I'm like, oh my God, I'm dreading this. And then I understand her like I never have before. And then I thought I wasn't going to put it in the book, but then I it was so moving. And I thought, this is just such a compelling way to say this. Like me, the person, the Harvard professor that studies this made the mistake. Like, so then there was a whole series of conversations about mom, like, I don't know, is it okay to share this in the book? Like, it's so meta. Is it too much? Is it? And we had a lot of conversations about it. And then in the end, she's like, you know, I'm 75. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Let's do it.
because you needed her permission.
Of course. I mean, well, it's funny because when I, and I know I'm like not saying what it is, I'm happy to tell you what it is. I don't know what level you want to go to, I'll say what it is. Before I say what it is, I know everyone's like, oh my God, what is it? So I wrote it the way I wrote it up was Jennifer and Donna. Like it was not me. Mm-hmm. And I sent it to my boss editor at the publisher, who was amazing. Courtney Young is her name. And she's also Canadian. And she said to me, she called me up. She's like, is this you? Because there is so much insight into the internal state that, and then I said, well, yeah, you got me. It's me. And then she's like, you either have to massively shorten it, or if you keep it this long, you have to say it's you because otherwise it will be confusing to the reader. Like, how is this made up? How does the writer, Leslie, have such insight into this person's state? So then that was a series of conversations about whether I should write it. And that's how it ended up. It was very meta. Okay. So what happened was when I was, before I married my first husband, the month before, I had really serious second thoughts. And because he was my best friend, I loved him so much, but I guess it was more like the physical stuff wasn't as, I don't know, heated or pronounced or whatever. But I, you know, he was a wonderful person and I loved him. But before, I know, you know, it's like right before the decision, this is gotta be some psychological effect, right? Right before it's like a final thing, mm-hmm. you're like, oh my God. And so I was having second thoughts. And so I called my mom and I told her, and she said, you know, she was very kind and comforting and understanding. And she said, I'm your mom. I just want what's best for you. And she said, you know, it's funny though, because for me, before I married your father, I had second thoughts too. And I'm so glad I went through with it because, you know, look at how happy we are. And they have a wonderful marriage. I had a wonderful childhood, like model relationship. And she said, you know, you already have the mature kind of love, this like infatuation stuff, it goes away and you already have the mature love. And so I always felt like really calmed by that. And so I went ahead. I'm like, this is great. And then it was not so great. And I ended up divorced. And then when I was, the kind of dust had settled from the divorce and I was sitting in my bachelorette pad and drinking coffee in the morning. And I get an email from my brother, the one that also loves therapy. And he's like, Les, check this out. And what happened as the email, you know, was, hey, boomer, the old adding someone to an email chain. My parents, it was started as an email just between the two of them. And then they were switched topics and it involved my brother. And so my mom added my brother to the chain. And so my brother looks at the very beginning, which was start as intimate conversation with my mom and my dad. And it was about my mom and my dad talking about how my mom was going to a lover's house. And it's like, you can't unknow this, right? It's so unusual to say the least. But it was like, clearly it was mutual. Like the two of them were talking about it together. It wasn't like a problem. There was no conflict. It was just like, if anything, it was like alluring between the two of them, which again is like, And so I just filled with rage because what I immediately went back to was this conversation that I'd found so calming that, you know, she had only shared part of the truth, right? She had undershared, and it would have been better for her to have said nothing at all than for her to have told me half the truth, right? She didn't tell me that in her marriage, the way they make it work is they have an unconventional, which I don't know how unconventional it is really, right? But I knew that this is not what I want, and I'm happy for them, right? Like whatever works as long as people are happy and safe. But I really felt like this had changed the course of my life. And I was really angry about it. Now, then but I never told her that I knew this for 10 years until I was writing the book. And, you know, over time, the rage faded and I found my Prince Charming. I know that sounds cheesy, but I found an amazing person, so much so that now I'm actually, psychology is weird, right? I'm grateful for my first marriage because I never would I never would be where I am now. And so it's all fine. And really, like, it was my decision to marry. But what was my mom supposed to do? It's the month before the wedding. Like, she's just trying to help.
Right.
So I sat down with her and I said, you know, when I was writing the book, when I'm like, I have to tell you that I know this. And I said, you know, mom, do you remember that phone call before my first marriage? And she's just said, yeah, I do. And I often wonder if I said the right thing. And it was just like, then like time stood still for an hour and a half as we had this, you know, we talked a lot. We talked about that and feelings and everything, but then we went so much further and, you know, and again, to your point about how you then have other topics that you grow from and it ends up being such a really life-changing conversation. So one of the things we talked about was we talked about love and how we experience love. And one of the things I shared with her was that when I had my first baby and they, you know, they put the baby on your chest. I didn't feel love. I felt responsibility. I felt curiosity. I felt fascination. I felt awe and wonderment, but you know how many mothers, they feel that love. And I didn't feel it. I just don't know this person and I really want to get to know you. But I've always felt a bit ashamed about that because I'm like, you're supposed to love from day one. And my mom said, you know, I felt the same way. It was the same with me. And, you know, she's such a loving mom and I'm obsessed with my children and I'm so goo goo gaga lovey dovey. But, you know, it's so this finding like shared mutuality and feelings and things that, you know, you would maybe if you left them inside, you would hold that unprocessed shame. I mean, maybe that's too deep of a way of saying it, but you know, so.
So I loved this book and I would have loved it if that story wasn't in there. It's got really nice blending of science and stories. When you revealed that you were Jennifer, like, I'm like, oh, I need to know this person.
Oh,
That was like I need to know and I was like, we're gonna be friends.
I knew
it was just like I just knew it and I hadn't even read the Alison Wood Brooks part. Which is like you have a whole
call that chapter an ode to Alison.
Well, and it's funny because when I finished it, I emailed her because I'm like, oh, and I don't know that she'd read that, like,
she hadn't. So she's like, send me and I just got the physical copies of the book. Let me show it. Let me bring it up.
Yeah.
And so I said, we talked about it, and she's like, no, I'm going to read it when it's the final physical.
Oh,
yeah.
There you
so
go.
She's not read it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what she
that's
said.
That's so cool and, that you and emailed the, her.
Yeah. Well, I had to, and you know, Norton, I know real
yeah,
well and,
yeah.
and you know, these are, do you know how we all met?
No. Was it a Second City thing?
Yeah. So Jennifer Acker,
we got connected
probably through Adam Grant.
Mm-hmm.
So like Adam has interviewed me for like every book he's written, and I'm never in any of them, which is fine. I'm not bitter about it. And so Jennifer is like, hey, there's a group of academics who are all interested in like comedy, and mm-hmm. And we got talking. And I was like, why don't you come for a weekend in Chicago? My wife Ann and I can like, we'll lead you through like a workshop. We'll go to shows. I think I pitched this. She might know differently, but I think that's what happened. So, you know, Jennifer and Allison and Mike Norton and Maurice and
oh,
like all like,
what a dream.
It is like, it's seriously like dream
yeah,
team.
Yeah.
They show up here. And the first thing we do is take them and lead them to an improv class. And so right away, they're like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And finally, and then we took them to Luminati's for Deep Dish Pizza. Then they all came to Second City and
amazing.
We explained the show and all. And so, like, these have been lifelong friends ever since that happened. We've worked on different things with different folks. But it is what your book is about,
mm-hmm.
which is we took this opportunity to reveal, to share. And in doing so, like, our life is so much richer for having known these individuals, and they've led us to amazing places. And I had a boss here once who, after a call, it was a biz dev call,
mm-hmm.
Was like, hey, you shouldn't talk about your wife in these calls. And I'm like, what are you talking about? First of all, my wife is amazing. And she's worked at Second City longer than I have. Mm-hmm. And she's got, it's her second book she just wrote, and she knows it. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, people, yeah.
And I've had people all the time are like, oh, I love how you talk about your wife. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, it's a good, it's,
yeah.
it's good.
Yeah.
And so the whole book is terrific, but I think you had to make that brave choice, and I think you know it. But it's a brave choice to reveal yourself.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, I'm sure there'll be haters, but haters gonna hate. And this book was such great therapy for me. Like, even if nobody buys it, it'll be 100% worth it, because it like really, yeah. It really helped me in so many ways, in ways that I didn't know that I needed help. But
yeah,
I also, huge kudos to you that you got Allison and Mike to reveal, because they are, like, I've been working on them for years.
Well, and again, when you're improvising, you know, the first things we teach is, you know, you reserve judgment of self and judgment of others.
Mm-hmm.
You get out of your fear and shame brain,
because
the only way you can improvise freely is in that state.
Yeah.
So you really, and Charles Lim is a neuroscientist who's done some studies with people. He studied a bunch of Second City people in an fMRI and, you know, showing that when you are improvising, you are lowering that part of your brain that is trying to protect you from that stuff.
Wow.
And you're open to experience. So you look at Dr. Keltner's stuff on awe, all of this stuff is connected. And it's exciting for me to have been able to, like, you know, spend decades doing this work without having any idea or interest in that there might be science behind it. And then at this period where I'm no longer interested in doing the day-to-day grind of producing shows, I'm able to explore and unpack what this work is, because I will tell you, the vast amount of people who come to take classes at Second City are not looking to get on our stage or go to Saturday Night Live.
Right.
They are using it as therapy.
Wow. Wow. Do they know that they're using it as therapy yet? Yeah. I love it. I love it.
Not at all.
Yeah.
All right. I could talk to you forever.
Me,
but
you too.
So let's end the conversation with a yes and story.
Oh,
this
feels
this is a like an easy one for you, I think.
Okay. Well, so the yes and was I took a phone call from a researcher, Rado Hofstetter. He just kind of cold emailed me, and I was like super busy and slammed. And I was like, oh, I just don't have the bandwidth, but I'm like, no, I'm going to do this. And then it became a beautiful collaboration and friendship. And, you know, you never know. I love this saying. This is an Alison Brooks saying. Well, other people say it too, I'm sure, but I learned it from her. Stuff leads to stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so I love that. If possible, yes, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful mindset.
The book is called Revealing: The Underrated Power of Oversharing. Leslie John, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.